Hey, please the court. My name is Mark Evans, number 40156. I'm a public defender here today representing Mr. Dennis Parker, and I will shoot to reserve about 5 minutes for rebuttal. Strictly from a fairness perspective, the greatest problem in this case is that although Mr. Parker only had the ability to defend against a possession charge, the state made this case about drug trafficking and sales. That was wrong, it requires reversal, and I'm happy to answer any of this court's questions about that or any other issue in this case. What I'm planning to focus on today is a far more discreet legal error that I think in the end was equally prejudicial. The district court's refusal to provide the jury with the law necessary for its evaluation of Mr. Parker's defense. The state's theory of this case was based on the idea that Mr. Parker possessed drugs because of a dog sniff, surveillance equipment, Ms. Cornish's initial statements, and most importantly, the fact that Mr. Parker was found in the same apartment where the drugs were found. His defense was that Ms. Cornish also had access to that apartment and the drugs were hers. And determining which version of events was true, it was quintessentially the role of the jury to apply the evidence presented by the parties to the law supplied by the court. And the law applicable to the circumstances of this case was that where a person is not in exclusive possession of a premises where an object is found, then it may not be inferred that he knew of the presence of the object or had control over it, unless there are statements or other circumstances tending to buttress that inference. That law had to be given to the jury because it was the central tenet of Mr. Parker's defense. The jury had to know that if it did not credit any of the statements or circumstances buttressing the inference of possession, it could not infer knowledge and control based on the non-exclusive possession of the premises alone.
Mr. Evans, I'd like to ask you a question about that. I think that there may be some difficulty in giving inferential type instructions to the jury, and considering that, why wasn't it sufficient for the jury just to have been instructed on knowingly? Why didn't that encompass?
Your Honor, the instructions did require the jurors to find actual knowledge or control. But the instructions also made clear that that finding of actual knowledge of control could be based on an inference. And in fact, jurors had to make an inference in this case because there weren't any drugs found on Mr. Parker. They were just on the premises. And what the instructions did not include is when the jury can, or in some cases cannot, make that inferential jump. The law that an inference cannot be made based on non-exclusive possession alone was never given to the jury. And that was critical in this case, because in this case, there were ample reasons why the jury could have chosen to not credit the other circumstances and statements that were admitted into evidence. And Ms. Cornish had every reason to lie in her initial statements to police, and in fact, disavowed those statements at trial and took a contrary position. The dog sniff of Mr. Parker's car was old, it was not specific to cocaine, and Ms. Cornish testified that she had driven the car. She was, after all, his wife. Now, even the Attorney General classifies that evidence as non-crucial. And ownership and use of that surveillance equipment was disputed at trial. It was frankly confusing at trial, and it garnered a grand total of 3 sentences worth of attention in the prosecutor's lengthy closing argument. So the jury could very well have found that those circumstances and statements didn't buttress anything, or could have just chosen to disregard them altogether.
Is this an issue of first impression, or are there other cases which talk about the inference of non-exclusive possession as a matter of instruction for the jury?
Your Honor, Haseley, the Kansas case that's cited in the reply brief, does directly support the idea that this law has to be provided as a jury instruction when the circumstances permit. Colorado law has not directly addressed this precise issue, but Nunez, Correa, and Odrogo all stand for the proposition that the jury has to receive the law applicable to a defendant's defense, not just a statement of the defense itself. And jurors get that law so long as it's supported by any evidence, even if that evidence is highly improbable. Nunez makes very clear that it is not the court's role to weigh credibility or the strength of the evidence supporting an instruction requested by the defendant, but that's exactly what happened here. I think also lending support to that idea that this has to be provided as a jury instruction, Barnes and Jolly, the two cases dealing with permissive and mandatory inferences, both indicate very clearly that it's the role of the jury to determine when facts allow for a certain inference. And then Carter v. Kentucky and People v. Crawford both stand for the very simple proposition that when an instruction of law is necessary to inform the jury's evaluation of the evidence, that law has to be provided. Carter is very applicable to this case because that dealt with whether or not the jury could make an adverse inference against the defendant based upon something that occurred in trial. And in that case, the defendant's decision not to testify. And the Supreme Court held that you have to get, when the jury is not permitted to make an adverse inference on that grounds, you have to instruct them that they can't make an adverse inference on those grounds.
How do we determine when an instruction is required or when jurors should simply be allowed to make inferences from whatever evidence is presented? Where's the line that we decide when the jury needs to be instructed about inferences or when they're just allowed to make those?
Your Honor, I think it's the same analysis as in Nunez and Hidrogo. And here it's not, again, this is not a case where you're telling the jury that it can reach a certain inference. I mean, the instructions did tell the jury that it could reach an inference of guilt based upon whatever it chose. What the instructions didn't tell the jury is when they could not reach a certain inference, and that was the critical message here that was left out.
May I just follow up with something? In terms of inference, it seems as though we're trying to draw a line here between when a permissible inference exists and when, for instance, a jury can rely upon circumstantial evidence and make permissible inferences as a result of circumstantial evidence. So I'm trying to understand in the context of what you're arguing now about inferences, where does circumstantial evidence and the instruction that we give jurors regarding the use of circumstantial evidence, how does that fit into this whole inference discussion?
Absolutely, Your Honor. To be clear, I'm not saying that the jury couldn't employ circumstantial evidence here. I'm not saying that the jury couldn't reach certain inferences. And that message is clearly conveyed in the jury instructions. But what Colorado law is clear about is that as a matter of law, if all you have is, somebody is found in a premises with somebody else and there were drugs there, that is not enough to convict. You have to have something else there. And if nothing else, just as a matter of efficiency, it doesn't really make any sense in my mind to allow convictions to be reversed, as they have been in Colorado, based on a sufficiency argument using that law, that's all they had, but yet not provide that same law to the jury to allow them to make that determination in the first place.
But didn't they here have more? I mean, we can debate how much the jury should have relied upon Ms. Cornish's statements given her recantation and inconsistencies, but if they chose to believe Ms. Cornish, which was within their purview, was that not something additional that would have provided that additional evidence, not just the fact that he was in the home?
Yes, Your Honor, it would, but that's why the instruction is so critical. I mean, it was the jury's decision whether or not, whether to decide that Ms. Cornish was telling the truth at trial or in her initial statements, whether to credit this dog sniff as meaning anything, whether the surveillance equipment meant anything, those were all jury decisions. The jury had to sort that out. But they were also all difficult decisions because it was not clear. Ms. Cornish did change her testimony, and there were questions about whether these other circumstances meant anything in this case. So the jury was also free to just disregard that stuff. And in fact, that's exactly what the prosecutor encouraged them to do. The whole, almost the whole thrust of opening statement and the primary emphasis of on closing argument was on the fact that he was in the apartment. And if the jury looked at all of that other evidence and said, you know what, we don't even want to deal with her statements. We don't want to deal with this dog sniff. What we know is that he was there, and there were a bunch of drugs there. The jury could very easily have convicted on those grounds because that was the thrust of the state's case. But you can't convict on those grounds. That's not enough. The jury had to decide whether it credited any of those other circumstances and statements, such as Ms. Cornish's initial statement to police, to decide whether there was enough there to convict. But the jury never got that message. They were never told that they couldn't convict under those circumstances. That's the problem here.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remaining 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Kevin McReynolds, Colorado Bar number 40978, on behalf of the people. There was no abuse of discretion in not giving an unprecedented jury instruction in this case. The non-exclusive possession cases involving sufficiency of the evidence are clearly distinguishable from this case on the exact grounds that you pointed to, Judge Ashby, which is that this was not a case where there was no evidence other than non-exclusive possession of a premises or being present in a location where drugs had happened to be found while other people were also there. Here we had substantial additional evidence, including defendant's own statement that it was his apartment, he lived there with his wife's statement to police that they had been using the drugs together, that he had provided the drugs.
Well, Mr. McReynolds, without an instruction that the defense is suggesting on non-exclusive possession, how do we know that the jury credited that other evidence or that their verdict didn't rest entirely on just the non-exclusive possession?
Because the jury instructions that were given, the elemental instruction, the definitional instruction on possession, on knowingly, because of the limitation on inferences, the instruction defense counsel requested here. Together, each one of those states, you must find beyond reasonable doubt that the prosecution has carried its burden to prove he knowingly exercised dominion and control over those drugs. There was no grounds for doubt there. It described possession as knowing, as dominion and control. You had to know that it was there. And the arguments focused on this point. They said, what this case comes down to is possession. Did he know the drugs were there and exercise dominion and control over them? And the jury convicted based on following those pattern instructions and following that repeated burden that you must find beyond reasonable doubt that the prosecution has proven by either direct or circumstantial evidence that these, number one, these were drugs, and number two, that he knowingly exercised dominion or control over them. That was sufficient. And the question that's raised here is essentially whether or not the trial court abused its discretion, made, if there are two reasonable means of addressing a situation, if the trial court chooses one versus the other, it's not an abuse of discretion. The question is, did the court abuse its discretion because the only possible way to address this issue was through an instruction based on cases that are frankly inapplicable? The Feltis and Petty cases both deal with sufficiency claims where there is absolutely no other evidence to other than presence at the non-exclusive presence at a location. There are no further questions on that issue?
Well, I'll just ask quick one. So there are a body of case law that finds trouble with inferential instructions. Mm-hmm. But what about Mr. Evans' argument that those involve inferences that can be made instead of inferences that cannot, or basically prohibited inferences. Is there a distinction?
In the current case, I don't see them as having any applicability. We do have, and there was an inference, a permissive inference instruction defense counsel requested and received here, which basically stated that inferences are, you may infer from one fact that other facts are proven, but you don't have to. In terms of guiding the jury in addressing the situation here, that was, if anything, overly generous. It's not a required instruction by any means.
Right. I was saying, I guess what I'm trying to articulate is whether or not the jury is instructed that they may infer something, is that different from telling them that they may not infer something? I guess cases like Wells is what I'm talking mm-hmm. about, you know, where they're talking about instructions about inferring things generally not being advisable. But here we're talking about something that cannot be inferred, and I'm wondering if you have a response to, I mean, that's the distinction that Mr. Evans is making here. And
I think that it's not a valid distinction in terms of, yes, there would be in some cases an impermissible inference that cannot be made as a matter of law. This case is not one of those because it doesn't fit within those cases where we do have an impermissible inference in this specific scenario, the non-exclusive possession of the premises. If we were in a case that was directly the Belts or Petty case, where literally the only evidence presented at trial was physical presence, non-exclusive control of the premises, I think it would be a closer question as to whether or not there could be a need to instruct the jury about that point. But those cases found, you know, as a matter of law, that's not enough to convict. We don't have that scenario here. We don't have anything actually even very close to that scenario here, given the testimony that we do have that was admitted regarding the use of the crack cocaine, the pipes being found recently used, and the testimony, the statements that his wife later recanted regarding where the drugs came from and all the connections between his apartment with only male clothing there and it being his apartment as opposed to being her apartment that he happened to be visiting. As I imagine the rebuttal will largely focus, I'm going to turn now to the mistrial motions here. Again, because we're dealing with an abusive discretion standard, in order to reverse, because the trial court, having heard the evidence and tried to proactively deal with evidentiary issues as they came up, this court would have to find that the only possible response to those issues at trial was a mistrial. If the trial court could reasonably take any other curative measures, as it did here, with corrective instructions, a written instruction specifically directing the jury that is not to consider any thoughts of trafficking or selling, but must instead, he's only charged with possession, you may only consider possession, that is the issue before you. Given that background, defendant's just not going to be able to make that showing, especially with the relatively innocuous nature of most of these issues and the way they were proactively dealt with by the trial court. You know, Judge Seymour immediately gave a corrective and direction instruction when defendant was referred to as a person of interest in a drug trafficking investigation. Number one, it's not nearly so prejudicial as saying defendant was trafficking drugs or anything like that. He could have been a purchaser, a witness to drug trafficking. He was somebody who came up during that investigation. But nevertheless, the trial court very, very effectively said, you are to disregard it. You must pretend like you never heard it. And it's not even evidence. I mean, we're talking about a mentioned opening statement. Investigator Cernich's unsolicited suggestion that the scale was a narcotic scale. Again, it was dealt with proactively and was more, it was ultimately a harmless point because defendant's wife herself identified the scale as one that is associated with or similar to the ones that she'd seen used for weighing drugs from her long experience as a cocaine user. And the Liggett issue, with regard to questions that were asked, the form of questions that were asked of Ms. Cornish, the trial court was beyond proactive in dealing with that, because even though it was not specifically a Liggett type question saying, were they lying, but instead was suggesting, so did the officer make a mistake in making his report, the trial court itself, sua sponte, objected to instruct that question. And when the prosecution made a similar form of a question, again, the objection was sustained, and the prosecutor was admonished in front of the jury that those are improper questions. You cannot ask questions that suggest any sort of request for an opinion about the truthfulness of another witness. And that is more than sufficient. It's more than sufficient under Liggett itself, in which questions that were raised, were they lying, and their answers were all allowed to stand. And the Supreme Court found that those errors were harmless in light of the entire record. Here, we don't even have the questions in the record. They were all struck. We don't have any answers to those questions that were allowed to stand. And yet, defense counsel is suggesting on this appeal that the only possible solution was a mistrial, and that any other curative measures were so obviously inadequate that this court needs to reverse the jury's verdict. And it doesn't appear that he can make anything close to that showing. If the court has any other questions regarding this or any of the other issues, thank you. I ask you to affirm.
Your Honors, I think regarding the other issues in this case, there's nothing that the Attorney General has said today that hasn't already been addressed in the reply briefs. Unless the court has any questions about that, I'll focus on the jury instruction issue. Judge Boris, you asked about whether there was any basis for treating an instruction permitting an inference different from an instruction excluding an inference. You can see support for that distinction in Carter v. Kentucky in the court's discussion of the Lakeside decision. I think that's on page 298 of the decision. The standard that the court's applying here is just a de novo review of whether the jury instructions got the necessary law to the jury. But since we keep talking about an abuse of discretion here, let me explain, what the court's actual error was. Mr. Parker made a motion for judgment of acquittal based on the same law of non-exclusive possession, and the court said, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, I see other circumstances and statements here in addition to non-exclusive possession of the premises. I'm not disputing that call on appeal. The error here was that the court then applied that same standard to denying the instruction of law to go to the jury. And that's not right. The instruction of law should have gone to the jury so long as there was any evidence to support it. So,
well, any evidence to support a negative is what you're saying? I mean,
that's, well, yes.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I guess since we're running out of time here on rebuttal, let me just articulate what is maybe hopefully my final concern. I'm interested in putting the tools in the right place in the toolbox. And traditionally, this non-exclusive possession has been used as a standard of appellate review, analyzing the sufficiency of the evidence. It's sort of consistent, as you're pointing out, that the court was looking at that in determining the motion for judgment of acquittal. And I'm just a little concerned about taking a standard of appellate review and transferring it to a jury instruction about how they can view the evidence.
And Your Honor, I know that at least in Colorado, most of the law directly addressing this is appellate in nature, but even the model jury instructions make clear that when you know, when a case calls for a certain law, you can provide the law and you can apply it from precedent if the case requires it. And as I was explaining to Judge Ashby, it just doesn't make any sense to me as a, from an efficiency perspective, why, you know, you could reverse a conviction on that basis, but the jury shouldn't be allowed to take the first cut on it based on that law. So, and I really don't think that it's any different from any of the other law that we provide juries when a case calls for it. And, you know, clearly this particular law is not going to be called for on every occasion. And there are not that many possession cases where whatever being possessed is not directly tied to the defendant. And, you know, the cases that we see, the Haisley case from Kansas, and I also, there is one Colorado case that I think supports what I'm saying. I just discovered it for prepping for oral argument, so I won't argue it, but I do want to give the citation to the court. It's People v. Stark. That's 691 P. 2nd, 334 at page 339, Colorado Supreme Court, 1984. If there are no further questions from the court, I just want to conclude by saying that this case was a mess. And I think this truly was a situation where the state's zeal to turn that mess into a win overshadowed the need to provide Mr. Parker with a fair trial. And that, combined with the district court's failure to provide the jury with the statements of law it needed to evaluate Mr. Parker's defense, requires that we try this one again. So I would respectfully ask this court to reverse Mr. Parker's conviction.
Since Mr. Evans, you brought up Stark for the first time, I'm going to give the people a week if they wish to just file a short response to the use of the Stark case. You can do that by way of a letter addressed to the division filed with the clerk.
Yes, Your Honor.